You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
English can be an ornery and difficult language, and nowhere is that more painfully obvious than in its spelling. The irregularities, exceptions, and tedium involved have made it the bane of many a schoolchild and almost every foreign language speaker. But linguist David Crystal celebrates those challenges in a new book called Spell It Out, The Curious, Enthralling, and Extraordinary Story of English Spelling. In it, he explores the past, present, and future of spelling with wonder, energy, and delight, and surveys the many and various influences that have shaped the development of our language and determined its odd spelling conventions. He also recounts the well-intentioned attempts to tame and regularize spelling, which invariably left the situation even more baffling than before. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings David Crystal to our show. Hello.
Leonard, hello. Nice to hear you.
I understand that after an interview on British radio, your book outsold 50 Shades of Grey on Amazon. Was that because after the interview, listeners came to understand that spelling would be more fulfilling as a pursuit, or did the torturous problems of English spelling appeal to those masochistic side, the people sides?
You know, it's one of those questions I would never in a million years have anticipated, that a book on spelling would outsell a book on sex. I mean, really. I have to be humble, though, because I didn't get ahead of a book on cookery. You know, that cooking always stayed ahead of spelling at that time.
I first have to ask you about your subtitle. Did you intend it to be taken ironically, or do you really feel that English spelling is enthralling?
Oh, I do find it enthralling. That's why I'm a linguist. And I think that's what people, I think everybody, every listener is interested in language. I don't think there's any question about that. Everybody finds it fascinating about the history of words. Why do they call something that particular name? You know, what this particular name mean? And when you get into spelling, it's had a bad history largely because of the rather dull way in which it's often taught. But when you realize that every word in the language has its own history, a unique story, and if you understand that story, you understand why the spelling has come the way it is, then it gets good.
Although not everyone agrees with you. You quote Thomas Sheridan, the 18th century elocutionist, saying that English spelling system is worse than the darkest hieroglyphics or most difficult ciphers which the art of man has hitherto invented.
Yes, that's right. He did. And there are still people who will say things like that, that English spelling is a total mess. Well, yes, there are complications, undoubtedly. My view is that if you understand the reason for those complications, it actually makes the task of understanding the spelling system a lot easier.
Well, George Bernard Shaw famously claimed that by following the conventions, you could reasonably spell fish, G-H-O-T-I, the F from cough, the I from women, and the S-H from nation. He was pointing out just how inconsistent its spelling can be, but he could have easily have substituted the O with the E from pretty.
Yeah, but that was a big cheat. I mean, it wasn't Shaw who thought that up. That was a 19th century development, and Shaw picked it up and really popularized it, so everybody associates it with him. But, you know, it was a con. It was a big con. Yes, goatee, G-H-O-T-I. And he said G-H is pronounced F. But the thing is, Leonard, it's never pronounced F at the beginning of a word. G-H is only pronounced F at the end of a word, you see, and T-I at the end, pronounced sh. That's never the case in English. It only is sh in certain positions in the word. So he was really, he had an axe to grind here, and he was making a point.
Well, does English have a more complicated system of spelling than most other languages?
Oh, yeah, sure. But there's a reason for this, you see. See, if you go back to the very beginning, to 1,000 years ago, Anglo-Saxon times, English spelling was absolutely regular, with just one or two little exceptions here and there. It was a phonetic language. If any of your listeners know about reading Old English at all, they'll know that they can read it quite easily. It's a difficult language to learn, of course. It's very different from today. But those spellings were easy in those days. And as you said at the beginning of the program, what's happened is that century after century after century, in come people who mess it up, slowly but surely. In come the French in 1066, and they start to mess about with the language and introduce spellings that weren't there before, and so it goes on.
Well, actually, you begin with the missionaries who arrived in Britain in the 6th century AD. What role did they play in developing the way we spell?
Well, these are the people who first wrote the language down, and they did it in a very logical and systematic way. I mean, anybody can imagine this. You go to a country, and there's a spoken language, and you've got the language you know, which in their case was Latin, and they know how to spell Latin. So what do? Well, you transfer the letters from Latin into English, and you do it as systematically as possible. And then when you find that there are sounds in English that don't occur in Latin, you borrow letters from some other local language, like the runes that they used, in order to fill out the system. But that original pronunciation and that original spelling was actually very, very regular.
Well, didn't the monks have problems with runes because they associated with heathenism?
Yes, they did, and that's one of the surprises. I mean, why on earth did they have runes at all? I mean, many people think that they'd have kept away from them. Well, this just shows, I think, they'd see runes as being somehow dirty. You can imagine a monk looking at a runic thing and saying, "You filthy animal! You know, I'm not going to have you in my system." But in actual fact, they introduced only three or four letters, mind. It wasn't very many. The basic alphabet was very Latinate.
And you point out that at the time there were 23 letters in the Roman alphabet. Mm. What was missing?
Well, the TH sounds, essentially. The two TH sounds, as in thin, with a th, and the, as in this, you know, that sort of sound. These two were not in Latin, and so they had to, but they were very, very common in Germanic languages and in English. So they had to find symbols for those, and they found them by going to these. First, the th sound, as in thin, they got from a runic alphabet, and the th sound, as in this, they got from an Irish alphabet.
Wasn't there also a h sound at the time?
Yes, there was, and that's still in modern English, of course. You hear it in Welsh, where I live in Wales, and you hear the h sound all the time here, and up in Scotland too. But they had to find a symbol for that one as well, and that was another introduction.
You say that you've been writing, that you've wanted to write this book all your life.
Yeah.
What's taking you so long and why now?
I was scared. I mean, even linguists are scared sometimes. What scared me? It was the size of the exercise, the extent of the exercise. I mean, if you're going to write a book on English pronunciation, it's not too difficult. There are only 30 or 40, you know, important sounds in English. Lots of variations, of course. But, you know, you can control that and write a book about it. Writing a book about grammar, not too difficult. There are only 3,000 or 4,000 rules of grammar that you have to sort out in order to speak English well. So you can get a handle on that. But there are over 1 million words in English, and each one has got to be spelled. And so it was the extent of the problem that put me off. And the reason why I finally ended up being able to do it was because something wonderful happened in the early years of the 2000s, and that is that the big Oxford English Dictionary went online. Mm-hmm. And if any of your listeners go to oed.com and call it up, then what you find there is what these OED guys have done is they've plotted all those variations in spelling over the last 1,000 years at the top of each entry. And so they've done all the donkey work. So it means people like me can now stand on their shoulders and see further.
My guest is David Crystal, who's the author of The Story of English in 100 Words and honorary professor of linguistics at the University of Bangor, Wales. His latest book, Spell It Out, The Curious, Enthralling, and Extraordinary Story of English Spelling. It is published by St. Martin's Press in this country. You mentioned that you introduced some of the techniques that have been used to distinguish long and short sounds, such as the double consonant following a noun with a short sound. Mm. That takes two sentences, and then 5 chapters later, we're still discussing the various exceptions to that rule. So how much of learning to spell in English is simply a matter of memorization?
Well, I'd say about 20%, something like that. And now, put it the other way around, 80% isn't memorization. In other words, if you approach English and look at it straight, you'll find that, on the whole, it's a pretty regular language. You know, cat is cat, dog is dog. There are no problems there. And there are lots of long words which are based on that kind of very regular system. Trouble is, you see, is that 20% or so of irregular words, they include some of the commonest words in the language. And so the irregularity is always in front of your eyes, as it were, when you're reading. And that's one of the difficulties.
Like the word hiccup and cough.
Yes. I mean, a perfect example, yes. I mean, the irony was that when hiccup first came into English in the 16th century, it was actually written in a very regular way. I mean, if you were writing hiccup for the first time and you'd never seen it anywhere, how would you write it? You'd write it H-I-K-U-P or mm-hmm. H-I-C-K-U-P or something like that. And that's exactly how it was spelt when it first came in. But then, you see, some smart aleck somewhere, and we don't know who it was, thought like this. They thought, a hiccup, it's a sort of little cough in the throat. How do you spell cough? C-O-U-G-H. Therefore, we should spell hiccup, hic-cough. You see, mm-hmm. and the word and the spelling transfers into the other word. The regular thing is lost, and that smart aleck, whoever it is, you know, he's left us with it as an irregular form.
You say that four of the letters in the Roman alphabet were given very little use in the early days when those monks were trying to transcribe Anglo-Saxon English into Latin letters. Which ones?
Well, the letters that are unused, I mean, a letter like K, for example, a letter like X, you know, some of these letters that are less used in the language, but yet have an important role to play, they're part of them. I mean, a good example of the sort of change that takes place, you see, is when the French come along in 1066. They had favourite letters. They wanted the English language. They were taking over now, remember. They have defeated the Anglo-Saxons. So they're now in charge. And they wanted the English language to look like French. And so they looked at some of those early Anglo-Saxon letters, and they just didn't like them, didn't like the look of them. And some quite common letters, actually, not just the rare ones that you mentioned, some quite common letters are dismissed. For instance, if you take a word like the plural of mouse, which is mice. In Anglo-Saxon, it was spelt M-Y-S, pronounced muse. Now, an S at the end was very typical of Anglo-Saxon, but the French didn't like it. Oh, no, that is not French, you see. I mean, that is not the way it should be. And so they replaced the final S with a C and an E, which is how we spell mice today. And similarly, a word like dance, which was D-A-N-S, becomes dance with a C and an E at the end.
But why did they change queen from C-W-E-N?
Same reason. They didn't like the look of that W. You know, it was another one of those introduced letters, not part of the Latin alphabet, not very French at all. And so C-W-E-N was the word for queen in Anglo-Saxon. Queen, it was pronounced. They replace it by your typical French spelling, a Q and a U. And everybody who knows French these days, who's ever learnt French, knows that Q and U are so important in the French language. And they were. It was also the case in the early Middle Ages also.
And it led the British to queue up for the bus. David Crystal's book is Spell It Out, The Curious, Enthralling, and Extraordinary Story of English Spelling. It is published by St. Martin's Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And David Crystal is the author, most recently, of Spell It Out, The Curious, Enthralling, and Extraordinary Story of English Spelling, published in this country by St. Martin's Press, and the kind of book that I know our audience just thrives on because our language segments are so popular. You mentioned earlier some silent letters. Why did K become a silent letter? Was it ever pronounced? Did we ever say kno or knife or knight?
He certainly did, yes. That's why they're there in the first place, most of those silent letters. In Anglo-Saxon times, they were all pronounced, every one of them. Right through into Chaucer, they were still being pronounced. And even into the early Shakespeare period, they were being pronounced. I mean, in Shakespeare's time, older people would still be saying things like kno and knight and things like that. But then during Shakespeare's time, it sort of fell out of use, and it became silent after that.
Well, you say that the ideal phonetic alphabet would be one in which each letter has just one sound, the sort of thing we see in Spanish. But in this country, I mean, in this language, in this country, in your country, we wind up with something quite different. Because there are so many different cooks involved in making this stew here?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about English is that it's a global language now. I mean, over 2 billion people speak English around the world. Now, no other language gets anywhere near that. And we don't just speak it in the same way. So there are all these dialect differences and accent differences in all the different countries of the world where English is being used. So if we tried to go for a phonetic spelling, well, you know, whose spelling would we go for? Would we spell schedule my way, or would we spell schedule your way? You know, there are so many differences.
You mean
of
the
this
correct
kind.
Way?
Yeah, exactly. In a sense, there is no such thing as correct spelling from a global perspective. Within an individual country, of course, there are the norms that make spelling in a certain way.
Well, Old English gives way to Middle English, and then we wind up with William Caxton, who changes everything again. Each one of these things driven by some historic moment?
Oh, I mean, the Caxton story is amazing. I mean, Caxton is the guy who in 1476 introduces printing into Britain, the first printed books in Britain. So he had to sort out the spelling system. It was a bit of a mess before that, and so he decided to choose certain spellings as the favourite ones, the ones to go for. But the trouble was, he messed it up in another different way, because you imagine it, we're in 1476 in Britain, in London. You're going to print a book for the first time. You have no typesetters. They don't exist. So you bring them over from the continent where they were before. Now, these typesetters arrive in London speaking Flemish, an early form like Dutch. And they don't know how to spell English, but they do know how to spell Flemish. And so they see a manuscript, and they take a word, and they unconsciously put in some Flemish spellings into the word. For instance, the famous example is the word ghost. You know, G-H-O-S-T. Where does that H come from? It wasn't there in early Middle English. It was spelled G-O-S-T. Well, in Flemish of the time, ghost was pronounced geest in the early Dutch of the kind, G-H-E-E-S-T. And these typesetters just put the H in without thinking twice about it, and it stayed.
They could have taken it out, but by then a Bible had been written with the words Holy Ghost, and so they felt it was not appropriate to take it out?
That's exactly right, because as soon as the Bible chooses a particular spelling, then it's sort of sanctified, isn't it, Leonard? And I mean, people then don't want to mess with it thereafter.
Well, Caxton also would alter the spelling of some words on occasion in order to justify the length of a line of print. So how many words have we inherited as a result?
Oh, it's difficult to say, because there were so many influences at the time. He was the first, but he wasn't the only one, you know. Over the next 100 years, this principle that you mention, you know, imagine you're typesetting in the old way, not on screen any, of course, but on the old way. You've got a line of type, and you put in all the words and all the spaces between the words, and you suddenly end up with a little bit of space at the end of the line. You've got to fill it somehow. How are you going to fill it? You're not going to use space all over the place. That'll look ugly. So what they did was they added a letter E very often to the end of a word. And some lines, therefore, had a word like had, H-A-D, spelled H-A-D, and another line would be H-A-double-D, and another line would be H-A-double-D-E. And so you get this huge variation coming in as a result of printing.
But we also, even earlier, we get variations like the word to, for example, T-O, T-W-O, T-O-O. Did that occur during the development of Middle English?
Yes, it did, because the T-W-O, the W was pronounced originally. It was another one of these silent letters that originally was pronounced, and then, you know, it sort of got dropped over the period of time. And so you end up with these words that are spelt differently but sound the same, which is another great pain when anybody's learning the English language, it's true.
Around 1200, an English monk named Orm wrote a book called The Ormulum. What was that supposed to do?
Well, Orm was the first spelling reformer. You know, you mentioned George Bernard Shaw earlier on. He was a great spelling reformer as well. Noah Webster, of course, a great spelling reformer. And Orm was the first one, a 12th century monk. And you know, why write language down in the first place? Why have spelling? Why have punctuation? And in the early years, the main reason was that priests and others would be able to read their sermons aloud and get it right, you know. They'd know where to pause, and they wouldn't mix up their words. And so Orm thought like this: there are an awful lot of spelling variations. Some priests who aren't very literate are getting confused, so I will sort it out. And he tried to sort it out. He tried to sort it out by saying, every time you have a short vowel, we'll put two consonants in afterwards. So, you know, hopping, as opposed to hoping, the o, the short o, would have two p's, whereas hoping would have just one p. Now, that principle is still around today, but Orme decided to work it out for the whole of the language. So a word like and was spelled A-N-N-D, with two N's. Well, you can imagine the sort of boredom of having to write everything out like that, and a lot of his reforms didn't stay.
But you say that until the beginning of the 11th century, English had its irregularities, but it wouldn't be described as chaotic. And then,
no.
I guess, William the Conqueror changed all of that?
Yeah, the French come in and make a lot of changes. The printers come in and make a lot of changes. But most of the changes come in the 16th century. You know, here we've got the Renaissance, so English is travelling around the world like the ships, exploring all over the place, finding all kinds of new things coming back. They've all got to be spelled. And the spelling is getting into an awful tangle. So a number of people in the 16th century thought like this. English spelling is becoming a mess. We need to sort it out. And they decided to sort it out by going back to Latin and introducing letters from Latin. They thought like this. What's the word for I owe you some money? Debt. How do you spell it today? D-E-B-T. Where does that B come from? In Middle English, it was D-E-T. Oh, but it was also D-E-double-T. Oh, and sometimes D-E-double-T-E. The 16th century people said to themselves, we can't allow that to happen. We must remind everybody, give them a mnemonic, which will remind them how to spell the word debt. I know, said somebody, and we don't know who it was. Somebody said, let's go back to Latin, where debt is debitum. Let's take the B of debitum and put it into the word debt, and everybody will thank us forever for introducing this silent letter into the word. And you think, that'll never work. But it did.
And then, of course, we have the word debit as well.
And indeed, a whole cluster of words where the B actually is sounded. And that was part of their argument, you see, that it would actually help everybody remember the relationships between these words.
A receipt is another word like that.
Yeah, it is. The silent P in receipt, the silent B in subtle, the silent L in salmon, and so on. There were hundreds of words like this.
There were no W's in Latin. When did W come into English?
That's another kind of late development. In Old English, it was another one of these letters they borrowed from the runic alphabet. It was called Win, and it didn't look anything like the modern W. And then in the early Middle Ages, the two U's, two-letter U's, come together to make a double U. You see, that's the origin of it. And you get this letter emerging and replacing the Old English one throughout the early Middle English period. So we're talking, you know, 12th, 13th century.
And then there is the confusion in spelling in this country and in Britain, where you end many words with an S. We would end it with what you call a Z. We call a Z.
Yeah.
Z is... Didn't King Lear comment on Z?
You unnecessary letter, says one of the characters in King Lear, indeed, as an insult, because Z was always considered to be one of those weird letters, you know, an unnecessary letter. Why, seeing as you can spell it in another way, why do we bother to have it in the first place? Was a common argument in those days, and Shakespeare is alluding to that when he has the Kent describe Oswald the servant as an unnecessary letter.
So we write surprise with the Z, but the British use the S. So have you decided that it's more unnecessary than we do?
Well, the British have got very confused in the last 100 years or so, and it's all your fault on your side of the Atlantic, actually.
You're blaming Noah Webster for problems in British spelling?
Well, I am a bit, really. It's in the 19th century, you see. The big Oxford University Press, which is one of the main movers in this way, decided to sort out the rules of English spelling in a way that would help people thereafter, in much the same way as Webster had done a century before.
But Samuel Johnson had done it for the British before.
Well, he had tried, indeed, but Johnson was the first to try and lay down some rules, and he got some right, and he got some wrong. I mean, a good example of a Johnsonian rule that went wrong was Johnson insisted that no word in modern English should end with the letter C. Absolutely out of the question.
That's comic.
Yeah, comic, music, all of those, critic. No. So he would spell them all CK, you know, and everybody's seen this, haven't they? You know, with music written in an old way with CK at the end. Now, he insisted on this, but within 50 years of his death, that rule had been dropped completely. And the same thing happened with S and Z, you see. Because there was this uncertainty in Johnson, the 19th century printers decided to try and sort it out. And they made different decisions from the way you'd gone in the States.
Hadn't there been dictionaries before Samuel Johnson?
Nothing like Johnson's. There had been dictionaries. The first English dictionary was a tiny, tiny little book written in 1604 by a man called Richard Cawdrey. And it was called, it's a dictionary of hard words. It was only 2,000 words in it. And so it's the first time anybody ever tried to define words in English. So that's the first one.
But, and Johnson was held in such high esteem that his opinion would have mattered.
Oh, absolutely. People thought of Johnson. You see, but by the 18th century, people had tried to sort out English spelling in all sorts of ways, like I mentioned with the printers and the Latin people and so on. And after a while, they thought, we can't sort out English spelling. There's only one thing we can do. Let's find somebody that we will treat as an ultimate authority. And just as in your country, Webster was treated in that way, in Britain, Johnson was treated in that way.
So did the British respond negatively to Noah Webster?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Even though his dictionary makes perfect sense.
Well, you know, this is, remember why Webster did it. Webster is on record as saying that he wanted a new language for a new nation and a new spelling system for this new nation. Now, why did he go for spelling so much? Because it's always in front of your eyes. You know, if you decide that there are to be some new words in American English, well, they'll just turn up every now and again. If you decide a bit of new grammar in American English, every now and again. But spelling is for every word, and he put a lot of dollars on spelling as being the identity for American English.
But English is a very welcoming language. We take words from pretty much everywhere, and then on top of it all, the British colonial system put a lot of people in touch with English, and they applied their own approaches as well. Did that upset the British?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, English is a vacuum cleaner of a language, a hoover of a language. I mean, it sucks in words from every other language it comes into contact with. Over 600 languages have loaned words into English. And, of course, the problem for spelling is that many of these words come in with the foreign spelling. And so, you know, words like bizarre and guitar and so on, these are not natural spellings for English, but they've come from the foreign language. And as they come in, people respect the foreign spelling and they add to the complexity.
You say that there are very few words other than prepositions and pronouns in English that are just two letters long. Why?
It's just a feature of the language. I can't answer the question why. It's just the way it is. English does not like two-letter words as content words, you know, saying something very important.
Go is an exception.
Go is an exception. Do is an exception. Axe is an exception. You know, AX, the way you spell it, I mean, it's got an E at the end in British. But, you know, there are not many words like this. The three-letter rule is the one that characterizes English. English likes to have words that are three letters long at least. So, you know, a word like, it applies to names as well. I mean, the name Anne, for instance, you know, a very common first name, really ought to be spelled A-N. But nobody would want to spell it that way because it would look too much like the indefinite article, you see. So they had an extra N on at the end to make it look more natural. And that's the characteristic of the language as a whole.
Well, the French, when they change things, they usually put some kind of accent mark, some diacritical mark, to let you know that changes have occurred, as they have in the words like côte and pâté and some others. But we don't do that in English.
No, we
Wouldn't
didn't.
That have helped people a bit?
Well, it might have done. I mean, we did try. I mean, if you go way back in history to sort of the kind of 900s, 1000s, and a little after that, you will see words written with an accent. You know, people did try that out. And when French came along and influenced English so much, again, you know, accents did start to come in. But for some reason, I don't know, people didn't feel it was the British way, you know, and they rejected accents. And even today, although some of them have come in over the last century or so, you know, words like cafe with an E at the end with an accent on.
Mm-hmm. Or blasé.
Blasé, that sort of thing, which helps the pronunciation. People feel it's not really a very, very English way of spelling, and they reject them. And so there is a lot of simplification going on here.
Well, a lot of simplification in the way people spell on the Internet as well. Do you think that that's going to change the way we think about spelling?
I most certainly do. I mean, spelling reform has never succeeded, with the one exception of Noah Webster. Apart from him, all the movements over the centuries, and there have been dozens of them, and the spelling societies, simplified spelling societies, still exist today with people arguing for a simplification of spelling. And the reason why none of these systems have ever worked is because nobody can agree about the best way of simplifying, because the system, English language, is so complex. Now, on the Internet, there's a very different thing happening, and that is that people are beginning to use their fingers to spell in the way that they feel comes most naturally to them. And although it's early days, remember the Internet's only been around 20 years or so, one can imagine 100 years down the road that a number of simplifications will come in. But I'll give you an example, Leonard. Over the last 10 years, I've been following the fortunes of the word rhubarb. Right? R-H-U-B-A-R-B.
Where does that H come from?
Another one of these 16th century, you know, let's go back to Latin kind of things. Let's go back to Greek, that sort of thing. Let's put the H in because it should be there because of the classical origins. Now, the H shouldn't be there. And it doesn't sound it. Nobody says rhubarb or anything like that, you see. And so on the Internet, I've been waiting for the H to be dropped, and I'm finding it. When I first did this in the year 2000, rhubarb with an H got millions of hits, and rhubarb without the H only a dozen or so. 2 years later, rhubarb without the H had 100 or so hits. A couple of years later, 1,000 or so hits. And so it's gone up and up. Last time I did it, it was 250,000 hits.
So if rhubarb had been mentioned in the Bible the way the word ghost has, we might still be all purists. On the other hand, people are spelling the word you with just the letter U. They're spelling the word four with the number four. That's one side. The other side is that we have spell check.
Well, spell checks help you if the word is unique in the language. But no spell checker on this earth will help you if you decide to spell the word plane, meaning an aeroplane, P-L-A-I-N, because P-L-A-I-N is a perfectly acceptable word in the English language, and it will not underline it in any way. One day the spelling checkers will become intelligent, but at the moment they are not, so they'll only help you to a certain extent. You have to be very cautious about using them, it seems to me.
Do you think that the Internet will be a vehicle for spelling reform?
Yeah, I think it will, in the sense that, you know, democracy rules here. If the vast majority of people on the Internet decide to spell a word in a certain way, eventually they will change our feelings about that word, and the word will become acceptable. And I think in 50 years' time, rhubarb without the H, along with the H, will become an alternative, just like, say, judgment with an E or without an E is an acceptable alternative today. Or the ones you were saying earlier, Leonard, you know, with an S at the end or a Z at the end. You know, these are alternatives that exist.
So English, as always, is a developing language, and we don't have an English academy the way the French have a French academy. Do you think that's
don't.
A good or a positive or a negative thing?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. Academies have never worked. I mean, academies have their value. The French Academy does wonderful work, but it doesn't preserve the language. French has changed in all sorts of ways in the 400 years since the French Academy was set up. And English has never been, the English temperament has never felt amenable to having people, you know, tell you how you should do things. We're much more aggressive in doing our own thing, aren't we?
If Scotland becomes an independent nation, as some people think it may, do you think that they're going to start changing spelling again to Scottishize it?
I wouldn't be at all surprised. This is the sort of thing that produced American spelling different from British spelling. Canada went its own way, you see, with a mix of American and British spelling. And this is what happens. As you go around the English-speaking world, you do see certain spellings that reflect the identity of the peoples in question. I wouldn't be at all surprised to find some new spellings coming into Scottish English.
David Crystal's latest book is Spell It Out, The Curious, Enthralling, and Extraordinary Story of English Spelling. It is published by St. Martin's Press, and I thank you so much for being on our show today.
It's been a real pleasure, Leonard. Thank you so much.
Thank you.